The first degree.
These things are supposed to happen in movies, not in real life.
The thing I remember about her most was her laugh. Her laugh was super memorable. You could tell that she was genuinely happy. She'd have these hilarious bursts of laughter, and I feel like you would instantly know that she was there and migrate towards it. And I called her on November 1st on her birthday, and left a message on her answering machine telling her happy birthday, I loved her, I'll talk to you later, give me a call. And I never heard from her. And I didn't think that was odd. She was a busy person, I was busy. And then I believe it was the morning of November 2nd, I received a phone call from my mom, and I answered, and she was really just quiet and silent. And I said, "What's wrong?" I decided I wanted to speak from my heart and say what I felt like I needed to say. You never find closure, but to find some kind of peace of mind in my heart.
Welcome to The First Degree, the true crime podcast that you might end up on. My name is Jack Vanek. I'm sitting here with Alexis Linkletter. It's another Wednesday. It's another episode.
Here we are, midweek.
Here we are.
Here to get you through hump day. Champions, all of us.
Exactly. We're recording this a few days before Wednesday. Obviously, we're not a live podcast. And I just saw the news that Gypsy Rose Blanchard got a restraining order against her ex-husband.
Listen, I have a theory about this. I think he really loved getting a taste of fame.
Oh, yes.
And I think he never dreamed he would get the attention he got. I mean, I don't mean this disparagingly. He's a normal man who's a teacher. And then he sees himself on the news and in the spotlight. And then she wants a divorce, and he's probably really not handling it well.
No, absolutely not. I mean, you could tell with all the interviews that they were doing and stuff. It's like, why is he in the interview? Like, this is about Gypsy. This is not about you, random guy that met her while she was in jail.
He's
definitely trying to insert himself
100%.
Way too much.
Well, we'll be following that saga, so we'll keep you posted. I would love to have Gypsy on the podcast. Let's try to manifest that.
I know. I don't think she's using her social media anymore.
She'll be back.
Maybe we can get to her somehow.
She's young. She'll be back.
She'll be back. I know. She's just she's going through a flurry of different things.
It's a roller coaster.
Fast.
Yeah.
But we'll get her.
We digress.
I wanted to shout out to our Patreon. If you are looking for more First Degree content, you've binged all of our episodes and you just want more and more and more, we have our Patreon, The First D Underground. We'd love for you to join. There's one full-length episode every single week for you to enjoy, and they have been really, really fascinating recently. So
we have been doing a great job. I'm proud of our Patreon. So like Jack said, a full episode every single week. If you join the $10 tier. So highly recommend. We love it over there.
Yeah, come join us over there. And there's new merch coming, and the Patreonies will get first dibs. So,
woo!
I don't know. Okay, well, that's enough of that. So let's turn down the lights.
And turn up your anxiety.
Because this could be you.
If there's one adjective that's used tongue-in-cheek today more than any other to describe our excitement or love for something, it's one we often see broken down into its two syllables for affect: obsessed. Sure, it's a catchy throwaway used ad nauseum to convey how we feel about everything from consumer goods to life hacks, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. Because underneath it all, we know it's hyperbole the way we're using it. No one's really obsessed with this stuff in the true sense of the word. And actually, admitting to being obsessed with something can be perfectly healthy if we have a life that's balanced out with several different interests and relationships. As long as something isn't consuming our every waking moment and not impacting our lives to a detrimental degree, then what's the harm? But what happens when an obsession extends from things to people, those in our own lives? And what happens when that turns dangerous?
We begin today's case on November 2nd of 2001. Celebrities celebrating birthdays today include musician K.D. Lang, actor David Schwimmer, and hip-hop artist Nelly. Speaking of pop music, Mary J. Blige is in the number one spot with her smash hit Family Affair, pushing Jennifer Lopez featuring Ja Rule's I'm Real down to number two. At the box office, the animated comedy Monsters, Inc., starring John Goodman and Billy Crystal, was the top-grossing film, followed by the science fiction flick The One, starring Jet Li.
The setting for today's story is San Diego, California. Situated on the coast of Southern California in San Diego County, the city of around 1.3 million people is located about 120 miles south of where Jack and I sit in Los Angeles. The second biggest city in the state is known as the birthplace of California. San Diego is home to many attractions where locals and tourists can capitalize on the amazing weather, including the San Diego Zoo, spectacular beaches, and the city's most historic old town in Gaslamp Quarter. And yes, the beaches are amazing. And Jack and I once went to La Jolla Cove and went snorkeling to see all the Garibaldi in the ocean, which is the California fish in San Diego.
It was so cute.
It was really cute. And there's also a ton of local craft breweries and things like that. San Diego is also where our first degree for today's story, Kelly, had very close family living. Kelly lived in Dallas, but her Aunt Julie and her baby cousin had moved to San Diego in 1988, where Julie's husband was stationed with the U.S. Navy.
At the time, I was living in Dallas, Texas. My aunt lived in California. Julie was my aunt on my mom's side, so my mom's twin sister. Julie also has a daughter, which is my cousin, and we remain really close.
Julie hadn't always lived in Dallas before moving to San Diego. She and her identical twin sister, Jill, were born on November 2nd, 1961 in Elmhurst, Illinois. When the girls were 5 years old, their parents, Kenneth and Judy, moved the family to Dallas, where the twin girls grew up with their two brothers. But things weren't always easy for the Kellen children.
When they were kids, their parents divorced. So it was the two of them. So the twins, they have two brothers. They grew up near Richardson, Texas, which is kind of like a suburb, actually next door to Dallas. They grew up there as like teenagers. Things were super hard for them after the divorce of their parents. They were living at one point with their dad in an apartment and having trouble making ends meet. And I think everybody in the house had a job and they were trying to keep things together. I believe they got evicted at one point because the parents just left and they were trying to figure out what they were going to do, where they were going to go to be able to survive.
From a young age, Julie overcame challenges and obstacles, all while maintaining unstoppable optimism. She grew into a loving and caring young woman when it could have so easily gone the other way and turned her into someone who was jaded with life.
Julie graduated from high school in 1979, and in the summer of 1984, when she was 22 years old, she married James Sawaya. Julie's twin sister, Jill, got married herself and went on to have Kelly.
And then each kind of married and went their own separate way. So my Aunt Julie landed in California, and my mom actually ended up in the Chicagoland area eventually. She was always so positive. She was always so motivated.
Kelly was super close with her Aunt Julie, even after Julie's family moved to San Diego for James's Navy job. Julie didn't let the distance get in the way of maintaining her family relationships. If anything, it made her more determined to invest more energy into those close connections.
She was so loving and caring. Family was extremely important to her. She was super affectionate. You know, she loved her nieces. She loved to give nose kisses and hugs and always tell you how much she loves you. As a person, as I got older and like getting to know her and seeing her outside of that kind of like childhood realm, the thing I remember about her most was her laugh. Her laugh was super memorable. You could tell that she was genuinely happy. She'd have these hilarious bursts of laughter. And I feel like you would instantly know that she was there and migrate towards it. She had just a shining personality. This warmth about her. She had a listening ear. She loved to talk on the phone. We would email. We wrote letters to each other all the time. Keeping family together and keeping them close, even though we were far apart as far as geographically, was super important to her. I think it was difficult. Even back then, before FaceTime and text messaging and all that stuff. They were constantly on the phone. She wanted to be an English teacher. That was her passion. And growing up, that was my passion too. I don't know if it was in our DNA or we were so close that I hitched my wagon onto wanting to be an English teacher as well.
Sadly, Julie's marriage didn't last, and she and James split the following year. James eventually moved to Tacoma, Washington. But there was no question that the center of Julie's world was her daughter, Kelly's cousin, who we're going to call Jessica, which is not her real name. She had her own battles as well, which Julie helped her fight every step of the way.
As a baby, Jessica was diagnosed with a rare liver condition called Alagille syndrome, which affects 1 in 100,000 children. One of the symptoms is persistent severe itching so bad that it bleeds, caused by bile salts accumulating in the bloodstream, which results in scarring from the scratching. In some cases, children can develop cirrhosis of the liver, necessitating a transplant and even developing a heart murmur due to cardiovascular abnormalities.
Julie made it her mission to work with the Alagille Syndrome Alliance as an advocate, not only to raise awareness about the disease, but to enhance the lives of her daughter and all those living with the condition. In 1998, Julie spoke to the San Diego Tribune about her efforts in community awareness and helping the other affected families. She didn't want them to feel isolated and helpless like she did as she waited for Jessica's condition to stabilize, which it does as children grow.
And of course, in the interim, Julie just wanted her daughter to have the best quality of life possible. So Julie began contracting pharmaceutical companies, inquiring about grants, and she threw herself into fundraising efforts. And she also helped organize the Alliance's 1999 Scientific Symposium in Portland, Oregon.
And at the time, Julie was working in ticketing at the Qualcomm Stadium, home to the San Diego Padres and the Aztecs basketball games. Julie even asked the Padres to donate autographs as she planned to use for future fundraising efforts for the Alagille Syndrome Alliance.
Her mom was her world. It's Alagille Syndrome. And Julie was just a huge advocate for it. Anything as far as like trying to find a cure or fundraising, looking into liver transplant options and just being a huge advocate so that others would know education around this liver disease and what it means and how many children have it and meeting with other families and kind of coming together to be a support system for each other for her liver disease. She was a single mom, so advocating for her daughter and this liver disease, it can't be easy, you know, sometimes working multiple jobs, but she made time and she was very resourceful. She wasn't scared to make those phone calls, to reach out, to put any kind of function or be a part of a function to help raise money and awareness.
Around 2000, when Kelly was just 19 years old, she took her young daughter to California to visit her Aunt Julie and her cousin Jessica. By this time, Julie was studying at Cuyamaca College to realize her dream of becoming a high school English teacher, which is amazing. And she was also about to receive a scholarship to continue those efforts.
She had a job and she was going to school. So that was her passion. Earlier that year, she had received a scholarship and she was being recognized. And she flew me and my daughter, who was two at the time, she flew us to San Diego so that we could see her get an award and recognized and a scholarship. So she was going to school and working. So it was the four of us. You know, we were both single moms at the time. We were really excited that she was getting the scholarship and she was being acknowledged. We just had the best time when we were in California. We went to SeaWorld, saw some sights around San Diego. We went to the beach, spent a lot of time in El Cajon. My daughter and I stayed with her and her daughter while we were in town for that couple of days.
While Kelly was in town, Julie threw a party so Kelly could meet some of her aunt's close friends.
She had just a small party, a get-together, that same week that I was in town. There was kind of a group of friends. And at the time, my aunt was dating one of the friends in the group. My understanding was they all kind of palled around together, hung out together. And once her and her boyfriend at the time, once they broke up, my Aunt Julie continued to be friends with the individuals in the friends group. And he was one of the friends that was in that group. But she had told me they're on the outs. He just like had broken up with her, maybe seen somebody else, but hadn't told her at that time. But it was like done with them.
Among this circle of friends was another guy named Gabe, and he seemed to be on the quieter side.
Some of her friends came over, and Gabe was one of those people that came over as well. He didn't really have a glowing personality. He wasn't very personable, at least to me. And honestly, he isn't someone that I would normally remember, except that I just remember thinking it was odd that he followed her around this party like a lost puppy dog. It's not like he was engaging with me or seemed to be engaging really with anybody else. He definitely wasn't the life of the party. It was just kind of odd that he was quiet, kind of in the corner, or just following my Aunt Julie around, talking to her, like seeing if she needed help. That's what I remember. He was just kind of like blending into the background, where other people, you know, I remember their faces, some of their names, but that was just the one thing that stuck out to me about him. And I don't even remember his name at that time. You know, it was just completely unmemorable.
In late October of 2001, Julie and Jessica went to visit Kelly and her daughter in Texas. But their time together kept being interrupted by somebody who was constantly paging Julie. Instead of just letting the messages slide, Julie always called the person back from Kelly's landline.
He continued to like page her and call her October 30th or 31st, which was the last time I saw her. He was calling her, paging her. And I just remember at one point she was in the room crying. It was just very kind of odd to me. I didn't know what was going on.
Julie and Jessica returned to San Diego in time for Halloween. And Kelly followed up by calling to wish Julie a happy birthday a couple of days later.
My Aunt Julie and my cousin, they left. I believe it was on Halloween. They wanted to get back to San Diego so that my cousin could go trick-or-treating with her friends. And I called her on November 1st on her birthday and left a message on her answering machine telling her happy birthday. I loved her. I'll talk to you later. Give me a call. And I never heard from her. And I didn't think that was odd. She was a busy person. I was busy. At the time, you don't have cell phones. So it's not like you're waiting for a text. And then I believe it was the morning of November 2nd. I received a phone call from my mom and I answered. And she was really just quiet and silent. And I said, "What's wrong?" And she just burst in tears. And she said, "She's gone. Julie's gone." And my ears started ringing. I couldn't just comprehend it. We don't play jokes on each other like this, so it didn't make sense. But I could tell in the seriousness of her voice that it was true. But I couldn't wrap my brain around it. My face felt hot. I just fell to the ground and I just started crying. I just couldn't believe it.
Kelly's world came to a complete stop. How could her beloved aunt, whom she'd seen just days before, be dead? Why did this happen and who was responsible? To answer all of those questions, you know the drill. You gotta go back.
In the hours following Julie's murder, police were looking into everyone in her life in San Diego, pulling back the curtain on all of her social connections. According to the San Diego Tribune, early on, police believed that Gabe Bradway, who was described by the publication as a, quote, 29-year-old unemployed construction contractor, was a former boyfriend of Julie's. However, an unnamed friend of hers said that she and Gabe were only acquaintances, with a follow-up report describing Gabe as a friend whom Julie had met through one of her exes.
The Tribune also reported that early in 2001, Julie had briefly stayed with Gabe when she was in the process of securing an apartment for her and Jessica, while Jessica was staying with her dad up in Washington. According to Gabe, the pair had dated, but it appears from what we can find on the research that that was not the case.
We didn't tell each other everything. But I feel like her and my mom told each other everything. And my mom knew nothing about this guy. I don't know if they dated and she just didn't tell anybody. But as far as we all knew, she was single. Could have been like, maybe they tried to date and it just didn't work out. It's just all so confusing to me. I've heard that they were dating at some point and that they had broken up. So from the side that I could see, if his feelings towards her, she did not share those same feelings towards him. From what I remember, she'd never mentioned him to me. So I wasn't like tracking him, like, you know, as far as like, oh, who is she dating? I thought she was single.
Even though it appears by everyone's account, except Gabe's, that he and Julie were never more than friends, Gabe nevertheless developed a deep obsession with Julie at some point. As Kelly thought on this more and more, she realized who had been paging Julie during her stay down in Texas. It wasn't another ex, which Kelly had assumed. It was Gabe.
So when this all came out, I was like, who? What's his name? I don't remember who said it to me or what exactly was said, but I just remember thinking, who? Who's Gabriel? Gabe? Who's Gabe? I think I remember him. I think that that was that weird guy following her around. Like specks of my memory come back thinking her pager was blowing up. She was on the phone and we didn't find out till later that it was with him.
More information began to emerge about how abusive Gabe had been towards Julie in the lead up to her 40th birthday, which was the day before she was killed.
That's when we started to like learn some more information just about my aunt. And at one point, he allegedly had come over and was arguing with her. And the neighbor supposedly heard her say, "No, not the stairs again." And he dragged her down the hair. Down the stairs by her hair. I don't know if that's true, which led us to believe that there was some kind of like abuse. She may have confided in friends. I'm not sure.
On the morning of November 2nd, Julie took 13-year-old Jessica to school, and Julie was really excited. Not only had she just turned 40 the day before, but she was due to start a new job that day in the ticketing office at Cox Arena at San Diego State University.
When Julie arrived home to her apartment just after 9 a.m., there was a knock at the door, and it was Gabe. He told Julie that he wanted to collect a pager he'd left there and asked if he could use her printer to print out a flyer for his contracting business. Unbeknownst to Julie, Gabe had a small sledgehammer with the bottom part of the handle sawn off, concealed under his clothing.
That was kind of the planning piece, instead of just it being something that just happened because they had an argument and it happened out of rage instantaneously. It was like, he planned this. He prepped the murder weapon. He called her. He came over and did that.
Once inside the apartment, Gabe attacked Julie for half an hour before killing her. He then changed into a pair of her own jeans and a Padres shirt so he could leave the apartment wearing something clean. He wrote and signed a note as Julie, which he stuck in the front door because he knew a friend of hers was scheduled to come by and visit Julie that day.
So I think he hit her in the head with a sledgehammer. She didn't die, so he choked her with the phone cord. He changed into her clothes, left his clothes there, wrote a note, put it on the door, something about like, I have a migraine. He left and then possibly realized her daughter's going to come home off the bus and find her mom.
After viciously attacking Julie, Gabe went to a convenience store where he dialed 911. On that call, he told them who he was and he gave them his number. And he said that a woman at Julie's address had a migraine and needed medical treatment.
He called the police and asked them to do a wellness check on her because she had told him that she had had a migraine and he hadn't heard from her. That was his story.
When officers arrived at Julie's apartment at around 11 a.m., they found the gruesome crime scene and Julie's lifeless body lying on a bed. The sledgehammer and Gabe's blood-soaked clothes were inside Julie's closet, and a blood-smeared pen was in the trash can.
The police came, went in, and found everything, found his clothes.
The medical examiner found Julie had died from multiple blunt force head injuries, in both manual and ligature strangulation. She'd been struck at least 13 times with this hammer, sustaining multiple skull fractures and a broken jaw.
Law enforcement began looking into anyone in Julie's close circle in San Diego, and within hours had arrested Gabe, apprehending him on Interstate 8 near Route 79. He told detectives that he'd sawn the bottom part of the sledgehammer off with a steak knife so he could conceal it in his pants. Under further questioning, he recounted how, 10 to 20 minutes after Julie let him into the apartment, she was kneeling to put paper in the printer in her bedroom when Gabe pulled out the sledgehammer and proceeded to brutalize his friend.
Julie had tried desperately to fight back, but it was no use. Later at Gabe's apartment, law enforcement found Julie's clothes that Gabe had worn when he left the scene in the bottom of the sawn-off sledgehammer handle and a bloody pair of socks.
My stepmom was kind of tracking everything that was happening. She told me that there was an arrest.
So what was the motive behind this horrific attack? Gabe admitted that his asking to use Julie's printer was a ruse to get inside. And when detectives spoke to her heartbroken daughter, Jessica, she said Gabe had been infatuated with her mother, calling their apartment every single day.
Gabe told investigators that he'd been planning Julie's murder for a month because he was upset by how she treated him after they apparently, and I put this in air quotes, broke up. Because, like we said, it doesn't seem that they ever really dated. The only person who says that is Gabe. He followed up by saying, quote, "I wanted her to hurt like I was hurting," end quote. He coldly told detectives he thought about killing Julie in multiple ways, like shooting her, breaking her neck, or even poisoning her. But when he saw the sledgehammer in a friend's garage the day before the slaying, he made up his mind at that point.
According to the San Diego Tribune, during his confession, Gabe told law enforcement that he'd met Julie through a friend. He claimed they'd been intimate after she broke up with this friend who she'd been dating, and this was the same guy that Kelly had known about.
Gabe's narrative was that he moved in with Julie, but at some point afterward, she told him to move out. Gabe told the officers, "I was at the end of my rope. She was a good person. She turned into a bitch. I didn't want this to happen, but it was something I had to do. She almost acted like there hadn't been a relationship. She just started being rude and disrespectful towards me. She acted like she had better things to do than talk to me. It's obvious I did it. I didn't want it to be that way, but I couldn't control myself." So if they really didn't date, he's imagining this resentment.
Yeah.
She's acting like we never dated, and it's probably because they didn't.
Right. It's like stalker light.
Yeah. It's just like projecting rejection onto her from like a relationship that never even existed. It's bizarre. Right.
Very bizarre.
You know, but Gabe also, everything he's saying proves that he knew exactly what he was doing and that he could have made a different choice at any time when he was planning this, and then he chose not to.
It was premeditated because he had sawed off half of the sledgehammer so they can conceal it. So this was like something he thought about. I can't even begin to imagine the thought process of somebody like that. The only thing that seems to make sense to me, and that the theory that we kind of have working with the family, is he just became enraged and jealous when she was out of town. I'm not sure if he planned to kill her because it was her birthday, but I just think like all the rage was building up while she was gone for some reason, all this jealousy. And then she came home and he came over and he killed her. At the same time, it's like he was so caught up in how he felt. He didn't think about the world or anybody else around him.
And even if Julie was scared, there's no way her family would have known, as it's incredibly common for stalking victims to not tell anybody about what they're experiencing.
I can speak from experience. Sometimes people that are in an abusive situation doesn't even necessarily have to be with a partner. There could be like shame around it or hiding it or not telling your full truth to your family.
Gabe was charged on November 5th with first-degree murder and using a deadly weapon. The hardest part of all of this for Julie's family, let alone her neighbors, who only ever saw her as a sweet and helpful person, was knowing about Gabe's pathetic attempt to redeem himself in some way so that Jessica wouldn't be the one to discover her mom in the crime scene.
Maybe have your family be miserable, but don't take the life of somebody that is so precious and amazing to others just because you are a jealous piece of shit. I think it was like 2 or 3 days later is when they charged him officially.
At Gabe's arraignment days later, he pleaded not guilty and was held in jail on $1 million bail. If convicted, he was staring down the barrel of the death penalty. That's because in California, if you're convicted of first-degree murder with the special circumstance of lying in wait, it automatically upgraded to a capital offense.
Gabe did his best to have the special circumstance lifted based on insufficient evidence, but that wasn't happening. Not only had he told detectives that he'd been planning Julie's murder, which is obvious premeditation, but that key element for the prosecution was Gabe sawing off the bottom of the sledgehammer handle. That obviously is even more premeditation. And it turned out Gabe had a history of this behavior as well. Apparently, he'd previously been arrested for stalking another woman, but that case, for unknown reasons, was not prosecuted.
Gabe's trial finally got underway in early 2004, and by now, prosecutors had chosen not to seek the death penalty. Gabe had also withdrawn his original plea of not guilty by reason of insanity after it was found out that there was no evidence to support the plea.
Kelly didn't attend the trial, but her parents did, despite the incredibly confronting nature of all this evidence. I mean, it would be horrible to have to sit in a courtroom and listen to all this play out.
When he was being prosecuted, my mom and my stepdad went there. They went to California and they were there for the entirety of it. My mom told me it was really hard for her because there was times that she had to kind of get up or zone things out so that she didn't hear the details or see the pictures. But it was really difficult, and she would call and kind of give us information. But of course, with the information that she gave to us, she would filter it.
31-year-old Gabe was found guilty in early February of 2004 of first-degree murder committed while lying in wait. Kelly and her mom attended the sentencing hearing 2 months later and gave victim impact statements.
And then they planned the sentencing hearing. And that's when I was living in Texas, and I said, I don't care what I need to do. I'm going to that. I drove straight from Dallas to California. I didn't stop, and I was by myself. And I knew that I had to say something. I had to advocate on her behalf. I had to speak and also speak to him. I had a little bit prepared, but really I decided I wanted to speak from my heart and say what I felt like I needed to say. You never find closure, but to find some kind of peace of mind in my heart. My mom went up to say her victim impact statement, and Gabe's family was sitting behind me, and they were talking, and I turned around, and I said, shut up now. And they were quiet the rest of the time.
The unique thing about Kelly's experience was she was the only person in Julie's family who had met Gabe, and now she had the opportunity to address him directly in court.
So when I was able to go up and give my victim impact statement, I just spoke from the heart and I tried looking him in the eye. He was looking down the whole time. I did say, hey, Gabe, do you remember me? Because I remember you. And just saying how it just destroyed all of our lives and that I'll never be able to get back those memories. And you're missing a piece of the puzzle that makes you who you are. And she was just gone, and how hard it is because your life continues, but someone that you love is no longer there. I felt empowered. I had tears because I was sad and it was an awful situation, but I walked away knowing that he heard me. He heard what I said. It made me feel like my aunt was with me, next to me, looking down on me. That she was proud of me because she would have absolutely done the same thing for me.
Gabe received the mandatory sentence of life in prison without parole. In court, he apologized to Julie's family and said he would have taken his own life if he hadn't been arrested. Bullshit.
Yeah.
They always say that. Understandably, Julie's loved ones refused to accept what to them were extremely hollow words.
And as Kelly left the courtroom, she had an unexpected but sobering encounter with one of Gabe's friends.
After we were able to give our victim impact statement, when we left the courtroom, Gabe's friend, he stopped me and he was like, hey, do you remember me? And I said, yeah, I remember you from the party. And what he said to me, I'll never forget. This isn't verbatim, but along the lines of, I always knew that Gabe was capable of doing something like this, but I never imagined it would be to Julie. That's something I'll never forget.
Gabe later appealed his enhanced sentence based on the special circumstance of lying in wait, which didn't make it any less painful for Julie's family, who continue to feel the magnitude of her loss today and every day.
He has tried a few times to either get moved out of that prison that he's in, to get transferred to a different prison, and then also, of course, try to appeal multiple times, trying to get out, you know, saying that the jail is kind of like unfit, you know, he can't get the help he needs, or things are dirty, or he's not being treated right, which I honestly believe, like, if you're a murderer and you're in prison, I mean, how are you supposed to be treated by other inmates? He's tried to even appeal to, like, get in front of a parole board, but they just shoot it down every time. It's like, not happening. 22 years later, she still has her days where she'll call me. We have in-depth, like, crying conversations where we talk and we laugh and we just share with each other, like, in memory of my aunt. She doesn't celebrate her birthday anymore because it happened on their birthday. And she's just now gotten around to accepting happy birthdays from people. Not happy, but I acknowledge that it is my birthday. Me and my sister's birthday. It's our birthday, is how she says it.
Of course, the one person this has impacted probably the most has been Julie's daughter. Following her mom's shocking murder, Jessica was able to live with her dad and stepmom, with whom she had a good relationship. They were able to help her move through her sudden and devastating new reality. Kelly explains that Jessica has grown into a woman that her mom would be so proud of.
They were so close. They did so much together, everything together, like two peas in a pod. And so when this happened, it like just ripped this huge hole, I think, in her heart. I was a bridesmaid at her wedding, and she had a picture of her mom in the seat next to me and a candle lit for her when she got married. That was one of the best days of my life, was seeing her get married to her person and being a part of that. Her whole world changed, and she is a strong, strong gal. She's one of the strongest people that I know. She takes after her mom. She's just so amazing. She's persevered. And I don't think if I was in her shoes, I would be doing as well as she has.
As hard as Gabe tried to make it seem like things were beyond his control when he decided to take Julie's life, they were not. And to be honest, that's probably still his narrative today. The one where he wants people to feel sorry for him and continues blaming Julie for what happened instead of growing a spine and owning the consequences of his horrific choices. Underneath it all remains a troubling dynamic of men refusing to accept rejection by women. Men like Gabe decide not to move on with dignity or do something useful like seek therapy or hit the gym to exercise their relationship demons and do the inner work to become emotionally secure human beings. Instead, they fixate, they obsess, always making the problems in their life someone else's fault. What Gabe forgets is that he had choices in all of this, and because he took one path over another, Julie is now left without any choices at all. The one thing Gabe's actions didn't do is diminish the immense love and respect that Julie's loved ones have for her, or dull the shine that her memory and passion for helping others continues to bring.
Huge thank you to Kelly for being our first degree guest for today's episode. If you are listening out there and you have a story to tell, please email us hello@thefirstdegreepodcast.com. You can follow us on Instagram, join our Facebook group. We're talking true crime all the time. Join our Patreon. We have a lot of new content over there for First Degree. And stick around tomorrow because we'll have a brand new episode of Killing Time right in your feed.
And remember, only you can prevent serial killers.
And keep your friends close.
But not that close. Shout out to Jared Monaco for scoring original music for The First Degree, producing by Caitlin Cleveland, writing and research by Gemma Harris. Sources for this episode are Court Documents, The San Diego Tribune, The Alagille Syndrome Alliance, Psychology Today, Scientific American, the British Psychological Society, Psych Central, and the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. And as always, our First Degree guest is always our largest source.